Hi, and welcome to another episode of Beerfest Brewers Roundtables. This is actually episode 22, and it's another good one. We had, this week, we had guests from St. Mel's in Ireland, Oso in Madrid in Spain, and Valdoc in Belgium. It was a good chat. We had covered a lot of ground, actually. We talked about the beer scenes in each country, had a little rant against Untappd. We talked about collaborations, a lot more. So it was a good, interesting one. Each have their own styles, and I think that it worked out very well. Just to note that Peter from Valdoc was delayed, so he's kind of missing from the first third, maybe, or so, first half of this. But he does come in, and they're all very interesting breweries, and I think you'll enjoy the conversation. So, let's chat beer. St. Mel's, we have Valdoc, and we have Oso. Now, Peter from Valdoc has sent apologies. He's stuck in traffic. He'll be about 10 minutes late. But we have Patrick here from Oso in Spain, and we have Liam from St. Mel's in Ireland. So the usual thing, we're just going to basically have a chat about the beers, about how they got into brewing, what they see as, you know, where they see their beers going, and what the beer scene in each country is, and just have a nice relaxed chat, hopefully.
I don't know, maybe Liam, since you're over in the corner there, maybe we start with you. Just how did you get into brewing?
Well, I started brewing a long time ago. I'm 20 years working as a brewer now. So I went to Maynooth University, and I did a degree in biotechnology. And while I was there, I got an internship with a company called Dublin Brewing Company, which were in Dublin city centre at the time. And it was the internship there that turned me on to craft brewing. I had wanted to get involved in brewing, but I didn't really know much about craft brewing at that time. This is back in 1999, 2000. So they turned me on to the whole idea of craft brewing. I worked there for a while. Then I did a master's in Heriot Watt in Edinburgh in brewing and distilling science. And then I worked with a UK brewer for a little while, learning about cask ales and how to do all that. Then I came back to Ireland to work for a company called Carlow Brewing Company. So I was there for about 10 years, their head brewer. And then I got married and my wife got pregnant with twins. So I wanted to move back, or we wanted to move back up to the Midlands. And it was always my ambition to open a brewery in my hometown of Longford anyway. So that's when St. Mel's was founded. So St. Mel's was founded in 2014. We started brewing in 2014. So here ever since. So that's a brief synopsis of the journey.
It's a long journey.
So
St. Mel's, I mean, you're looking at it, if I understand right, I mean, you're like you mentioned there, it's very local. It's very much a local focus. And I think you get a lot of your ingredients are trying to be local, and it really, the place you're from, would that be someone?
Yeah, we try to root ourselves in the community. So, like, we chose the name St. Mel because it's synonymous with the area. There's a cathedral named after St. Mel. The school I went to was St. Mel's College. There's all kinds of stuff named after him. He was a saint, or apparently he was a saint. There was a nephew of St. Patrick, and he founded the church in my business partner Owen Tynan. His home village, Arda, that is where the original St. Mel was, and the ruins of it are still there. So it all kind of tied in nicely. The other thing that happened was the year we opened up, St. Mel's Cathedral in Longford Town burned down in 2008 fire, and they refurbished it over 6 or 7 years, and it opened the month we started brewing. So it was all a very happy coincidence.
That's a good omen, I think.
Well, we hope so. We hope so. Anyway.
So maybe look, just might as well get open a beer because I'm a bit thirsty. Like, I'm looking at the beers you sent on. How would summarize your beers? I mean, what are you trying to go for with beers?
Mez beers. Well, you know, when we started the brewery, craft beer had just really taken off in the country, but there was very little of it around the Midlands. The beers we started producing are designed to be very accessible and kind of crossover beers. They're not meant to be the wild, wacky, super challenging beers that a lot of brewers are nowadays. So we started with a Hell's Lager, a pale ale, and a brown ale. And we did that because we wanted people to move over from their Smiddics or their Heineken or whatever run of the beer they were drinking without scaring them off craft beer. So they were never too strong and they were never overly ambitious or groundbreaking. They were the original core beer that we did. We added a seasonal range then where we got a little bit more experimental with things like raisin and oatmeal stouts and elderflower wheat beers. And the way they were received gave us confidence to be a little bit more experimental as we went along. And nowadays we release 6-7 new beers a year, and we tend to experiment a little bit with ingredients and stuff and styles there. We've recently kind of got into Belgian styles actually, so we're doing a lot of Belgian inspired stuff these days.
Okay, and is that just purely because that's your interest, or do you think it's market driven?
It's not market driven at all. I'd say our core beers, we do a canned range and a bottled range, and I'd say those core beers are quite market driven. But the limited editions we do are all about we're interested in.
And right. What we've had. Of the ones you have there, which would you think, like you sent on, there's a slow burner stout, you sent your spice bag Saison, which got quite a reputation, and your Asher Lookit, which was in a can. Which would you think? Like, what would you recommend if you're someone wanted to know what St. Mel's are trying to do? Which one of those do you think we should open?
I'd say the slow burner stout is a good example of what we do. It's just a really well made stout, full of flavor. That's right. So it's a classic of the style, and that's what we try to do. When you brew a style of beer, we try to make it full of flavor and to be, you know, on point with the style.
Right. Did you try that, Patrick?
I'm going to open it now. I'm going in. I wasn't sure. I saw about 30 beers arrive in my house, and I thought this is going to be a big tasting.
I have to drive somewhere later, so I can't be too bad.
But I'm going to crack it open now.
And how about yourself? Well, actually, just give us what your opinion of it there is, because you sent on a couple of stouts as well.
We sent our coconut stout.
Yeah, and I actually found just a while ago you have a real pastry as well, but maybe we'll just focus on this one first. So talk about So when you started, this isn't the stout you started with. This is a special, is it?
It's part of our core range now. So we did a series of dark beers a few years ago. We did a black IPA, we did a Schwartz beer, did a slow burner, we did a couple other ones. I can't remember what they were now, but we asked people which one they'd want to see come back as part of our core range, and 80% of them said the slow burner, so that's what we came back with.
Yeah, well, I mean, stouts is obviously Ireland. Stouts are the bigger part than probably most other countries. Like,
stout on draft is huge, but dark beers in general and off licenses aren't as big.
Okay.
They don't. They sell this time of year. Stouts are great this time of year. Everybody wants to have one, but you know. Spring, summer, not the biggest seller, and you have to be a little bit careful about how many different stouts you have out at once, because they can end up getting stuck on off license shelves if you have too many of them in your range.
Right.
But in pubs on draft, stouts.
Yeah. No, like I'm thinking. Yeah, obviously Guinness. You know, obviously has influenced drinking in Ireland. You know.
Mm.
How about you?
Yeah. And look, we're known all over the world for our stouts. Probably, I'd suggest when we got the reputation for our stouts, we probably didn't deserve it. But now there's loads of fantastic stouts out there. So there's like my old brewery, O'Hara's, Porterhouse, just so many that you can name that they're doing. Not just fantastic draft stouts, but fantastic bottled and canned stouts as well. There's just an amazing amount of them.
Yeah, no, there's a lot. I've seen like nitro stouts are suddenly coming into, I don't know whether it's a fad or I see a lot of nitro stouts suddenly popping up everywhere.
I think stout is a style of beer. It's one of the few styles of beer that nitro really suits. Where a stout is very much about mouthfeel, and nitro beer accentuates the mouth. Doesn't do much for the aroma. Can deaden the aroma quite a bit. But in terms of mouthfeel and getting those malty flavors into your mouth, the nitro helps that. So I think that's why nitro suits stout, and works sometimes with a red ale as well.
Right. How about you, Patrick? What did you think of that one? Did you try it? Well, you did.
Yeah, I just tried it. It's lovely. It's very, very, very smooth. Like you said, mouthfeel is fantastic. Nice and roasty. It's the kind of beer I miss out here, because it's the only stouts that are really imperial stouts, and normally with adjuncts. So getting like a just sort of a more classic, you know, anywhere between 5.5% to 7% stout is a lot harder to find here. So it's great when you can.
Yeah, I've Yeah, that's one thing I'm always doubtful about adjuncts in it, because I don't know if you agree, but I was told that they're very hard to get right, because you can think you've got it right just up to the last second, and then you just have one drop too much and it kind of destroys the whole thing.
Yeah, and there's not, you can't take anything out. I mean, you know, obviously. So, that's a bit of a tricky one. But yeah, that is that's lovely. I mean, I used to work before Rosso for a brewery in London, and we used to brew loads of dark beers. And I do miss that side of things, but we just find beers, so we are unable to do a lot of them.
Right, yeah. Well, yeah, maybe give us how did you end up? You're obviously not Spanish. How did you end up in Spain?
So I'm English. I studied here on my year abroad when I was at university, which is where I met my now business partner. And we kind of always had the plan to come back. I was working in brewing I've been working in brewing now for 7 or 8 years. And started coming back over to Spain for sort of beer festivals and events, and then just saw that things were sort of starting to move on here, starting to pick up, and thought, you know, we want to do something. We kind of the plan would be to move back to Madrid. Nice lifestyle here, really. And we just thought maybe we'll give it a go. We'd seen, we thought we'd just give it a go. So that was about 3.5 years ago. We set up about 3 years ago with our own bar as well, in the middle of town. And it's an interesting beer market here. You know, it's very, very dominated by a few very big players, obviously San Miguel, Mao, Estrella Damm, Estrella Galicia. But there is a big group of people here who are really getting excited about having choice and having more options. And yeah, you try and cater to that, obviously.
Isn't that kind of the case in every European, certainly most European countries? The market is dominated by big guys.
Yeah, I think it is. I think the one thing we get here is that someone like Mao, which is San Miguel, same guys, and it'll be sort of, so people don't really see them as being like a massive industrial, you know, multinational beer company, but they'll just be so popular here in Madrid, because people like even sort of AB InBev aren't that strong in Spain. Okay. So you're kind of competing against, these guys that have just like really haven't had any competition other than maybe Heineken for, 40 years. And so they, think about what it was like in the UK, where you'd have lots of Tide pubs and a real stranglehold on the market for the big guys. Here, you know, every bar you go into will only have one beer. It changed people's minds a lot. In that respect, you know, at least in the UK, okay, there'd all be brands owned by InBev, but you would think that you had choice. You think, well, I could Budweiser, or I could have Kronenbourg, or I could have Stella or whatever. Whereas here, it's just you go into a bar and you just say, can I have a beer? And they'll give you that beer. And it's, you choose the size and that's it. So we, we have 8 taps in our place, and people will still come in and go, I'll have a double, which is, sort of 2/3 of a pint. And that just, a lot of people don't want to choose. They just go, that's what I have. And they'll be very, very shocked if you have something that isn't the local Mao, basically.
So do you and your bar have a kind of go-to beer? You're uneducated, when they come in and just go, I want a beer. Do you have lager there? You lash out to them?
Yeah, we always have a lager. We're street, right in the center of town. So we'll always have a lager on that we can, we try and have a slightly more interesting offering, whether it will be a lager made by a smaller Spanish brewery, or, we get international stuff in as well. Have nice German lagers on, or Czech pilsners and stuff like that. But that's good for us as well, because if they start having something different with something that isn't a huge leap, then they start to sort of, we have a chance to sort of chat to them about what we do, give them a little taster of, a pale ale or a table beer or something that might be not, too far out. And then we've got a chance to sort of, show them what the idea is.
5 hours later, they're throwing back a coconut marshmallow stout and telling you you've used the wrong hops in your IPA.
Why do I get back to anything else?
But is that, in your bar, is it mainly, do you have locals? Is it, or regulars, locals? Are they tourists? What's coming in?
We get a real mix. Obviously, the last couple of years, a lot fewer tourists. But we, Saturdays and Sundays on our street is kind of, our street is maybe 500 yards long, and there's about 70 bars. So there's loads of tiny bars. It's very, like, you know, traditional kind of Spanish. Lots of people standing up or at high stools, quite compact. But, you know, the way they drink here, they like to be rammed in. You know, they don't like too much space. It's been obviously a big challenge during the pandemic. But the thing is, you pop in, you come in, you go for a beer there, and then you...
Sticky internet.
Yeah, it comes and goes there a bit.
Dropped off.
Yeah, there, you come back in a second. So, yeah, so, I mean, you, obviously, it's just you, you know, so we... So you don't have a tap room, do you?
No, we so in Ireland it's not legal, or it's not a right for a brewer to license to have a tap room, which is the case. After a lot of lobbying, we got the government to introduce new types of license in what was called the Craft Beer Bill in 2018. Yeah. I think. So that allows you to have a producer's retail license or a producer's on license. And when COVID hit, we decided to get one of these businesses, and we looked at the tap room, but you're very limited in your opening hours, and you have to run it to the same standards as a pub. And by that I mean you have to have the same fire safety efforts as a pub, and you have to have the same levels of standards as a pub, which is fine and fair enough, but you can only open between 10 and 7, so you don't get the nighttime trade out of them. So we chose to go for the producer's retail license, which means that people can pop into the brewery and buy a bottle of beer or two bottles of beer or a case of beer or whatever they want, which was illegal up until this bill was introduced. So somebody couldn't come to a brewery in Ireland until 2 years ago and buy a bottle of beer. They could buy like 4 cases of beer, but they couldn't buy a bottle. It was there from Victorian times. It was to protect pubs back in the
day. Yeah.
Once that law got changed, we got on that and got a business retail license, which allowed a couple of things. It allows people to call into us, but it also allows us to sell online and ship direct to people. So we call it direct to consumer, but our direct to consumer trade is really what sustained us during the various lockdowns.
Right.
We were one of the few breweries with the appropriate license to send beer direct from people's houses. Other people got around it other ways to partner, but that was how we did it.
Right.
But no, we've no tap room. And we don't have any immediate plans because of that license law where you have to be close to 7 o'clock.
Right. And before the pandemic, like, was most of your sales through pubs? Was it draft or was it?
We were about 70% hospitality before the pandemic. It was a huge area of focus. And I've said it before, but in 2019, the start of 2019, put together a business plan that was very much about selling into hospitality. That was our entire strategy for the next 3 years. So after about 3 months, that got thrown out the window. Sorry, not 2019, 2020. So we had to throw that out the door. And that's why we went to just retail license. We had to completely rebalance and redo. We had never put beer in cans before that.
Okay.
So we started putting beers into cans. We thought people were shopping online for cans. Turns out they prefer bottles.
Really?
Cans. Yeah.
Because that's something I've been finding interesting. Like, I would have thought, yeah, bottles, like, they do have a heft and they do kind of give it a sense thing. But I was always surprised that cans seem to be customer driven. Like, lately,
the off licenses we deal with all want cans, or 80% of them. But for us online, bottles are a bigger seller. Whether that's just because of the beers we have in bottles compared to the beers we have in cans, I book bottles are a bigger seller. Right. Which surprised us.
You know, like I said, I was surprised.
It was a bit annoying while we figured out how to get bottles safe at a courier.
Yeah, no, the
and expensive.
Yeah, well, that's the other problem with bottles. Like, I mean, shipping cost on them is you're paying so much for the weight of the bottle. Like,
yeah, well, it costs the same with us if you buy a big cans or a big bottle, it's shipping the same cost. They are there's obviously still a quality perception to them out there. That's latent, and we find it with hospitality as well. A lot of our hospitality customers don't want cans.
I can understand that in hospitality. I mean, if I was in a restaurant and you're having you want a beer, I would feel a bit odd, even though I know it's going to taste the same. If they brought me a can, I'd just, you're out for a night. It should be, the bottle feels special. But yeah, because I mean, I've just been surprised that, you know, when people put stuff on cans that were on bottles, you see people on Facebook and Twitter and stuff going, yeah, it's on cans. You know, I'm just amazed at the consumer demand for it.
Yeah. Look, No, a lot of people talk up the environmental and sustainable aspect of cans, but I've actually read a few papers that the bottles are probably, unless the can is made of 100% recycled aluminium, which I don't place with any cans, it turns out that the bottle is actually more sustainable. Add all the stuff up together. Only marginally so, there's not that big a difference between the two.
And it probably depends on what kind of ability you have to recycle it, you know, where...
Yeah. And then we have a system here where bottles aren't returnable. Speaking as a brewer, I'm pretty happy about that because the headache and we put it into a bottle bank. We have a glass factory on the island, and all the bottles go to them, and they turn it into bottles. And we get bottles.
Right.
It's a fairly sustainable loop from our point. So I know that's not the case everywhere. In Ireland, a brewer who's buying bottles from a factory on the island, those bottles are consumed on the island and put back into their factory for recycling.
Yeah. How about you, Patrick? You were saying there before you got cut off that you were.
I've moved room. I'm now sitting on top of the router, so hopefully.
Right. I think it seems a better connection, to be honest with you.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
We do everything in can. We struggle to sell cans to like non craft focused on trade for sure. Like if we want to get into a nice restaurant, most restaurants here they want a bottle. There's already. Again, it's a legacy thing as well, massively here, that you would drink cans at home, maybe. But if you in bars, you can drink from the tap or bottles. You know, there's just you would never go to any kind of bar here where they would serve you a can of beer in the bar. And I think that's just something that people haven't really moved on from. In the places that are more, you know, beer specific, it's kind of accepted. But it's also a headache, you know, if you packaging lines for either are not cheap. So you do sometimes have to kind of make a bit of a play for one or the other because, you know, getting a good quality bottling or canning line is very expensive. So it is tricky to service both. And we think at the moment we've got less of a market in bottles or less ability to compete with the people currently doing bottles in this country as opposed to... being able to sell a lot of off trade and online, but like I said, we've never done bottles. Where I was working before in London, which was Anspach and Hobday, we did bottles and we did lots of quite traditional styles in bottles. And even then, when we put them into cans, it just took off. It just went mad. But I think there's possibly, believe that it might be coming back around the other way. I definitely think you can see that. And I think when you want to reach a wider market, which at some point, obviously, we would like to do, because I'd say we're quite niche at the moment, then I think bottles is definitely something we'll have to look
at. Yeah,
we Nomad Brew, so we don't have our own space. So we brew in three different places, and all of them have canning lines and no bottling lines. Two of them have bottling lines, but they've basically stopped using them. So everything we do goes into can.
We're quite lucky in this country, only called Bevcraft, Irish Craft Cannon, and they're just a half an hour up the road from us, but they have mobile cannon units.
Yeah.
They come to your brewery and pack it for you. They're really successful, and they've got a load of small brewers into cans who wouldn't have been able to put beer into cans. Huge help.
I remember when that... some people started doing that in the UK, and five, 6 years ago. And yeah. I think at the start it was a little bit, you know, they were sort of starting off with not that high level machines, and they were bringing them around in the back of a van, basically. So I think there was a few things that were causing a few issues, but they've definitely ironed that out, and now it's as good as having your own canning line, I think, really. So it's great. But yeah, I think that helps. But yeah, I think, like I said, for getting into, you know, wider, you know, into more restaurants, into more bars, into more a wider range of places, bottles is still essential here in Spain anyway.
Right, so that's really, and are you with your own bar, is that where you're selling now? Is it mainly, or assuming there's no pandemic and stuff, like are you selling most of your stuff through your own bar, or are you selling it through packaging or into restaurants? Or
we sell about 20% of our beer through the bar.
Lower than I would have thought.
Yeah, well, we package normally about 17 hectoliters, and we'll do about 20% of that in the bar. Then we'll do about 50% of it distributed in Spain, and then we'll export the rest. And now through the pandemic, obviously the web shop picked up a lot, so that obviously takes on a fair chunk of it now as well. But yeah, our bar is, you know, you can fit about, well, you can legally fit about 25 people in there. You can fit about 40 people in there without it being crazy. But because of the way they did the COVID restrictions here, we were down. So we were allowed sort of 12 people in the bar for most of this year. So obviously we really dropped. But yeah, even with 25 people, yeah, we'll be doing about 20% of that batch in keg through our bar. We're starting to see the like people coming to the bar and taking away cans of our beer. That's going up quite a lot now, which is really nice. As much as you can sell direct is always good.
I see a comment here from Tarrison Octo Brewery. He was trying to meet up with you. He said I think he visited you. Well, he said it was that it was a nice bar.
Oh right. Oh, that's nice. Yeah.
That's the wrong one that came up there. But he was saying that there seems to be a lot of basically a pretty good scene around scene around Madrid overall, but he made a comment on that he wanted to try and meet up with you when you were there, but called it a bar and had a drink anyway.
Yeah, no, Madrid is good now. Like, I'd still say Barcelona is a bit more, you know, they get more tourism there, which obviously helps with this kind of beer, and probably a more international feel to the city. Whereas Madrid is still quite traditional, to be honest. But yeah, because most of the bars are, you know, they have one beer, they have a Rioja and a Ribera del Duero red wine. It's just like, you know, you can pretty much get the same thing in lots of different places. I think that has given a lot of opportunity to people who want to do something different, to still kind of get people to take a bit more notice. I think if you open a craft beer bar now in London, people are going to be like, great, you know, another one, you know, like not, you know, it's not, it's, people will say, what are you doing differently? It's got to be something that's got a real like unique selling point. Whereas I think here, you know, it starts to get to the point where most neighbourhoods will have something like what we do. People are catching on. It's growing pretty quickly. So, you know, hopefully the future looks good for the market here in Spain.
Right. Just to bring it back around, I suppose, because you were saying, like, well, you were saying there about, you know, he started off with what I think was pretty much the standard of, you know, in Ireland when craft brewing was starting, was you had to have your lager, your stout, your red ale, and that was, you know, they were the ones, or else the bars wouldn't take much notice of you. But it sounds like that's still, like you said, you need something to get the people off, you know, the big multiples, so you need your lagers in there as well. But I noticed that you seem to do a lot of, you know, kind of double and triple IPAs, so that there seemed to be a mismatch there for me.
It's two different things. So for the bar, we'll always have a lager on, but it won't necessarily be one that we make. But we, you know, beer is cheap in Spain. Like taxes are, it's about 5 cents a pint of tax here. So beer is very cheap here. So we look at it and we think, well, we could try and make a very good lager, you know, brewed the right way and all sorts. But we wouldn't be able to come in at our size and the way we brew anywhere near competitive. So we look at where we can be competitive, and we make a lot of, very hop forward double IPAs, sort of future double IPAs, and a lot of sort of hazy or New England styles. Those are the styles that are within the small, you know, the smaller segment of the market that is people who like craft beer. Those are the styles that sell best. It's more for us what we're going to be looking at in terms of the next stage. So if we want to grow and we want to start packaging, you know, big amounts and brewing a lot more and establish, you know, a bit more of a core range, which is going to be something that we, you know, we really try and roll out nationally, then we're going to have to start looking at having some lager and working on, you know, things like, you know, kind of like a session IPA that people can kind of get their head around and that they can enjoy, but it's going to be, you know, more appealing to more people, I guess. But it's not, you're not sort of constrained here by any, you know, there's not really such thing as traditional styles, because there's not as much of a beer tradition here. It's, you know, people drink lager. They might not even know that Mao is a lager, you know, they're just like, it's Mao, that's what I drink, you know, or it's Estrella, that's what I drink. So it's kind of, you're not really constrained by there being traditional styles, because there's really, you know, it's kind of,
monocultural in terms of beer. There's just one.
Right.
Yeah, that makes up a huge amount of the market. So we've been able to find our sort of part of the market by doing, very hobby styles. It's quite quite like sweet things here. So, you know, those sort of lower bitterness, you know, much more sort of tropical fruit, floral stuff, definitely go down very well with it.
Right. Yeah, well, I know Liam opened the, and I had it the other night, it was Nature one, which I thought was really nice. I drank it on Wednesday night because I was looking for something on that I didn't want to have, like, you know, 10% or something like that.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, no, Nature, I mean, so that's just, that's where we kind of, you know, this is part of our testing, the one product that we really want to get behind. And I think it will be a sort of 4.5% pale ale or session IPA that we can get into small pack at a really competitive price when we're brewing a lot of it. And I think, you know, we obviously look at, you know, Spain we see as sort of a beer market that is probably behind, you know, obviously you'd say maybe the US was the most advanced in terms of time. Then you're looking at, the UK and Ireland and Scandinavian countries maybe as being the ones who are probably then the next step ahead. And then we would see ourselves as you know, in terms of timeline, being a bit further behind. So we obviously look at the success of someone like Beavertown before they became Bottle Heineken. But, you know, the success that they had with a product like Neckar, which really just took them, you know, to that next level in terms of popularity. And so we look at it and think that makes sense, because that was a really nice beer that you could, you know, that didn't, you could have more than one. And, you know, like some of the double IPAs we do, you have two cans and you're kind of struggling. So, you know, we definitely look at that as well as those being the kind of beers that we like to drink, because, you know, the sort of British and Irish pub culture means that you drink pints. You know, you don't just drink a thimbleful. You know, you want to go out and be able to stay in the pub for a decent period again without, you know, being completely legless after three beers. So, you know, sessionable beers are the kind of stuff that we like and that we drink. And we think that, you know, for us to help us grow and for the market to grow, that's kind of where we need to position ourselves in the long haul. But doing the odd...
Nature is a lovely beer. Yeah. And Mosaic is a really funny hop. It goes really well, really badly. It's done really well there. But every in Ireland, every second beer that comes exact is dieted.
Yeah.
It's like a reasonably sessionable, very hoppy beer. You know? Oh. And it's a style that's starting to get a little bit... It's starting to get a little bit... what's the word I'm looking for? They're all starting to taste the same.
Okay, yeah.
Because there's so many of them out there, there's very little room to stand out in that area.
Yeah.
We feel We do a couple of those kinds of beers, but it's very hard to perceive the difference.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I think that's why we're kind of keen, because it's still very much... you know, we'll have our pub, we'll have three beers on at the same price, and people will probably lean towards getting the one that's the strongest alcohol, because they'll kind of be like, that's the best value. And so there's a lot of people who still really focus on that here in Spain. It is big strong double IPAs, and we kind of want to get ahead on the more sessionable styles to kind of, you know, establish ourselves as sort of people who do that very well, and we're not lots of other people trying to do that. And then we can maybe, really settle on having one beer, you know, like I said, like an echo, you know, when sort of first of the season, that it becomes established as a brand. It's not just about the brand of Osso as the brewery. It's, we have this beer that, you know, you really can roll out and get into, sort of all the shops, and the shops that take it, you can do a lot of it, offer it at a good price, and you can, you know, they can be taken home crates instead of cans. Is where, you know, we want to go, because those are the kind of beers that we love. And then you do one-offs, you know, where you can have a bit more fun and do smaller batches of those just to keep us happy.
Yeah, that's something I was wondering about, like, on branding. I suppose we're kind of coming around to it on branding. Like I said, I mean, in the past, you know, that the big ones, the brand was the single beer. You had the brewery was Guinness, the brewery was Heineken, the brewery was Carlsberg, and they had one beer which kind of made them. And where do you see that going now? Like, you need to, brewers now seem to need to brew multiple different beers, keep coming up with something new all the time. So do you try and focus on building a brand around a beer? Does a brewery just have to be kind of focused on a particular style of beer? How do you see the branding on that going?
I think the brewery is the brand now. Certainly in independent breweries, the brewery is the brand. When you get into the bigger stuff, it's a different story. But But for us, the brewery is the brand, and the beer names need to reflect the brand, or the you need to reflect your brewery's brand in the beers that you make and the beers that beer, how you name that sort of stuff. So,
and does that limit you, though? Do you think then that you have to try and limit down to doing like mainly one style of beer?
Hold on. You can do any beer you want as long as you keep your brand values when you're naming it and when you're addressing the label and that sort of stuff. My opinion on it.
Yeah, I just want to say I'm having the Saison now and it's fantastic. The spice bag. That is great. You know, starting to hear some Christmas music around, and this is
do you know what a spice bag is?
I don't think so, no.
Spice bag is something you get from the takeaway over here. It's like chicken and chips all mashed up with some vegetables, and there's a kind of a spice troll.
Right. So
we got a guy called Aaron Kapil, who runs a company here. He's an English guy, but he runs a company here called Great Saffron Spices, and he imports spice direct from India. Really fresh stuff, really high end, and he's well known in the restaurant trade over here. We got him to create a spice bag mix for us, and that's what's in that beer.
It's great. I love it. Again, Saison is a style that you just don't see it enough over here, and I really miss it. And it's great. But yeah, anyway, onto the point. I just thought I'd say it because I was enjoying it.
Because I had that one last night, and I was trying to figure out the spices in it, but I finished it before I figured out it was going to go easily.
But yeah, I think it's a bit of both. Like, I do think you're right that the brewery is the brand. You know, people will. There's definitely if I go into a pub and I see a brewery that I've had many good beers from, I don't care what beer it is. I will think these people are probably making good beer. So I'll have one of those. If it's a style I like, obviously, if it's a style I'm not that keen on, I won't. So I definitely think that's true. And I think in terms of styles, there is probably an element of you'll get to some extent pigeonholed whether you like it or not. You know, I mean, you're not in full. You can never be fully in control of your brand. You know, if you start to make a lot of a certain style, then people will start to associate you with those styles. You know, I think that can definitely help you. You know, I think it's quite good to have a position in the market. You know, we've got you know, here in Spain, we've got these guys called Soma Brewery, and they just brew really hoppy, mainly double IPAs, triple IPAs. You know, they don't, maybe they'll do one in 50 beers, they'll do something else. And the people that like that know that. And so, you know, if you have whatever the percentage of the market, people who love very hoppy beers, they are very loyal to that brand. And so, so I think that that's another element. But I also think that when you go, if you want to go very big, which is not necessarily, you know, we want to go, but if you want to start doing if you want to get as big as someone like, you know, Camden or Beavertown, obviously these are both guys that got very big with, you know, with the help of bigger businesses. But I think that when you want to go that big, you probably do have to back one product, because, you know, we're all people who we're insiders, aren't we, really? So we know a bit more of the nuance of each brewery, and we'll go, yeah, I tried a bit of this from them, tried a bit of this from them. Whereas, you know, we're not insiders in something like wine, and there'll be, you know, people who, you know, I'm sure someone like Oyster Bay, they probably make various wines, but their Sauvignon Blanc is the one that is everywhere and is really taken off. And I think that you probably do, if you really want to go to a mass market, you probably do want to get behind one beer, in my opinion. I don't think there's that much space. You know, if you're an insider, you've got a lot of space in your mind for different breweries and brands and products. But if you're not an insider, if you're just a casual consumer, you've only got so much space in your mind for, you know, these different brands, in my mind. And if you want to get to that market of people who aren't, you know, they like craft beer for what it is, but they're not enthusiastic, you know, they're not craft beer enthusiasts, then, yeah, you probably do want to have just one thing that's very simple for them to understand. This is the product, and you should go back and buy this again.
Yeah, I suppose that brings it back over to like Untapped, you know, where I've had people come on and say, like, you know, they basically Untapped, all it means is that they have to turn out a new beer because you can't get someone else to, you can't get someone to try the beer twice. You have to completely come up with a new beer every time because they just want to check it in and that's it. They don't really care about.
Yeah. I hope that's going to change. Over the long, I mean, Untapped is a it is a bit of a phenomenon. You know, it is something that is important. You know, we've seen it with, we brew styles that are kind of, that will generally get a better rating on Untappd. You know, if you do big hoppy double IPAs, you know, we'll be very honest about it. Like we've sometimes brewed sort of New England style, didn't get it. Right. And then, you know, we'll go, this is not our best one. And then they'll get like a 3.9 and you're like, oh, right, okay. Whereas if we'd have messed up, you know, or not messed up, I mean, not done a sort of the best example of, a sort of brown ale, then you could just be getting, you know, threes and below and stuff like that. So that definitely does happen on the tap. I don't know why it happens. I don't know why it's got to there, but it does. And then, but it also, we've seen it, you know, if we want to try and start with a new distributor or we want to start with a new importer in, you know, wherever, in a country where we've got no base and we've got no real ability to sort of go there and enter the market. That is the first thing that they'll look at, I think. And so if you can have a good rating on there, it definitely...
But does it limit you, do you feel an urge then that you have to produce a new beer, a new style of beer all the time just because people won't, you know, they'll just move on to the next thing just so that they can tick it off a box?
I think that has, and this is actually not just with our beers, but firsthand in the bar, I think that has died a bit. I think that people are now actually, I see more and more people using it going, oh, have I had this beer? Because they've had, I don't really use it, so I don't keep track of how many beers I've had, which is probably for the best. But it's, these people are like, I've had 10,000 beers, which obviously you can't remember all of them. And then they'll come back and they'll go, oh, yeah, I had this and I'd like to, so I'll have it again. I think it's people, like craft beer is expensive normally. It's normally more expensive than the competition. And so, you know, I think people are starting to get a bit tired of the risk of spending €7 on a pint, which in Spain is a lot. I don't know what the pricing is like currently in Ireland, but, paying over the odds for a pint of what they can get for other stuff and being disappointed. You know, I think people are coming back to wanting a bit of certainty in and saying, well, I'm going to pay €7, but I really want to know that I'm going to like it, because we've all been there. There's nothing worse when you've bought a can of beer or whatever and you spent, you know, a decent amount of money.
Yeah.
And it's not very nice. And that does happen. But I think people want to limit that. And we see that with our beers. You know, we'll tap a beer for maybe 2 months before it goes and we do a new release. And we see that those are, you know, we've got a lot more people going back to those instead of where previously maybe they would have come in and gone, oh, you've got this in the fridge, I've got to try it. That real like hype element, I think, is starting to change.
You see that, Liam? Do you think that's happened as well, that you're seeing more people coming back, or have you always had the people just coming back for the same beers?
I'm a bit unusual with brewers, and they pay absolute on tap whatsoever. Wouldn't care less about it. I used to care about it for about 2 or 3 years, and I sat down one day and figured out what percentage of my customers had tapped in on Untappd, and it was less than 0.001%. It was less than 0.01% actually on Untappd. So my customers don't use it. My ratings aren't great on Untappd because I pay no attention. I've never brewed a beer with Untappd on mind. And nobody I know uses it amongst. So
yeah.
Now I do accept that it is very useful when you're looking to export market. But nobody we've spoken to about exports has ever mentioned their Untappd rating or ever asked us about Untappd rating or ever. And the longer you're on Untappd, the closer you veer to 3.5. So ultimately, that's where you'll end up. I always think business, if you live by your ratings, you're going to die by your ratings as well. So I just don't care about it.
Yeah.
Having said all that, I do see ratings getting bigger, and there are more and more young people are interested. So people of my generation or my age, you mentioned Untappd to them and they look at blankly, but if you mention it to somebody in their 20s, they get all excited about this new written beer thing. So maybe I need to start thinking about it a little bit more, but it's not something I think about at all. I look at it sometimes, and when there's good ratings, I'm delighted, and when there's bad ratings, I don't look at it. That's my relationship with Untappd.
Yeah. I think, just caveat what I was saying, I mean, I think that when you start out, no one knows who you are when you start out. So you don't have a brand. And so I think that, you know, when you start out, which we've only really obviously with all everything with the pandemic, it was only really just over a year that we really started to up our production and start brewing a lot more. So I would say that when you're starting, it can be something that can give you a big leg up and can kind of, you know, get you moving a bit quicker because...
It totally can. And there's brewers I know who, you know, their entire reputation is built around their untapped score. But that's great when the untapped score is good.
Yeah. But you need to, you know, so you have that. And then I think that you need, you know, like you said, you can't live on it forever. You've got to build that brand with, you know, with having loyal customers that like you regardless of what your untapped rating is. So I think for a new brewer, it can be worthwhile, you know, considering it because it can open some doors for you in terms of, you know, your distribution. But it's not a long-term, you know, I mean, look at the if you, you know, just looking at it in terms of monetary terms, you know, there's not a good correlation between breweries that sell the most beer and their untapped ratings. You know, the biggest brands, they don't care. Of course they don't care because they're able to, they've built a brand in sort of, I guess, the traditional sense and not just based on, oh yeah, this is a good rating. So I completely agree that it's not, I'm not like a evangelist for untapped by any means. I personally don't use it. But I think it is, like I said, I think at the very beginning, you know, it is, you know, it helps to have good ratings on there. But like I said, we wouldn't brew something that didn't sell just because it got us a good untapped rating as well. You know, we brew stuff because we think it's good and because we obviously have to sell it, you know, because it's the business. So we wouldn't kind of adjust the strategy massively. But yeah, over
there is,
time.
There is the thought as well that if you want to go and capture it, do double IPAs and Imperial Stout for your entire life. You
know? Yeah, well, that market is, you know, that market, you know, that's great within that market. If you've got a 500 litre kit and you can just keep doing that, then great. Yeah, you know,
yeah. Make money, you're never actually going to pay for another kit.
Yeah.
Capture it and it'll be 4 points up.
Yeah, yeah. So that's it. So yeah, again, completely agree with that. And I think it's, you know, over the long term, it's not a good indicator of, it's definitely not an indicator of how successful brewers by any stretch. And so,
I'm interested to know if Belgian brewers care about on tap now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Peter, welcome. We were just having a chat about
talking to you, Peter.
Hello. Very sorry. It took longer than expected because the Brussels traffic, it's horrible. Very, very sorry, but I'm glad I could make it.
Okay, well, it's good to have you. So, yeah, I don't know if you caught any of that. They were just discussing Untapped and how important or not it is or what it forces you to do. Do you pay any attention to it?
Untapped, I don't use it myself, but I know my our marketing manager, he really looks into it. And it's a good indication of quality or keeping your quality consistent. For example, we had like oxidation problem. And when you're in the brewery and you drink your beer, it's fine. But when it leaves the brewery after some months, you don't know what happened. So it's a good indicator, good feedback to know, okay, we have a serious problem. We can take action. Yeah. So it's helpful, but yeah.
But you're not focusing your thing on, I have to make a new beer just for Untapped.
No.
So tell me, since you came here, so you're in, obviously you're in Belgium, and we've just been kind of tasting and trying out everyone else's beers here. So you're around since when? 2018, 2019?
2017, we started brewing.
Okay.
4th of April, yes. So really young.
You're up to date for me down there. I was looking, I tried two of the beers here tonight. So you're really, maybe you can sum it up for us. Like, I mean, you seem to be trying to do very kind of brew within Belgian traditions, but do something a bit different with them. Would that be, you know, make them a bit more modern or?
Yes, we keep like traditional styles. So it's not something really fancy or fashion, but we try to really keep the balance in our beers, especially the hoppy ones. We try to use a lot of hops, but don't make it too bitter or keep the Belgian balance in our beers.
Yeah, because I mean, just my experience of it is that obviously Belgium has a very strong, you know, proud brewing history between the Abbey beers and the Saisons and the Lambics and all of that. But it became a bit conservative. Would I be right in saying like it doesn't like change until it's only starting to kind of
Yeah, I think we're a little bit behind. That's one of the reason I started also brewing, because 10 years ago there were like only doubles and triples, and they're all the same styles. It's changing, but slowly. I think internationally it's going much faster than here in Belgium. But I think now it's interesting to see all the new craft brewers in the scene. It gives some action to the brewing.
Yeah,
It's changing, yeah.
I found that when anybody I've had on from Belgium has said the same thing. Like it's been very, very traditional, and obviously for good reason. Like, I mean, it's been, good beers. And Liam's starting to brew some Belgians. He said he's getting into more doubles and triples as well as you're moving away from them.
Yeah, but I do see the bigger brands in Belgium are starting to experiment. They're bringing out variations of their styles where they emphasize different hops and yeasts, which they never would have bothered with even 5 or 10 years ago. But it's always the same in every country when independent brewers start to experiment and start to create variation. When the bigger breweries see the success of that, they start to experiment. And while we're seeing it in this country, the two big breweries now are kind of starting to present themselves with a slightly more crafty than they would have before. I'm sure that's what's happening in Spain and Belgium too. I saw it about 4 years ago in Portugal. I was there for a beer festival, and the big brands down there were all presenting themselves as crafty images as well.
For sure, here in Spain, yeah. I mean, Mao, San Miguel, I think they now own maybe all of Founders, and they basically bought Founders, which is kind of a shock because, you don't see Mao as like a huge global player, but and they just went and bought Founders. But they basically got them to make them a session IPA, and they got them to do some more craft styles to try and tap into it. And it's interesting for us because obviously the thing about IPA is it's a completely different. For those big businesses, it's a completely different like supply chain model, because they'll be used to having the beer needs to, hit the shelves on this date, and then it can stay there for however long. So you get some quite old IPAs out there from them. But if it introduces a star to people, it's not always the worst thing, as long as it's okay and they don't just think I don't like IPAs because I've had one and it was.
That is true. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot in Belgium now. There's a few starting to do, very IPA, like Brussels Beer Project and that, but I think that's not the style you're going down yet, is it? Or do you want to go down that? I mean, you have the ones I tried the other night. There was apple and blackcurrant. Is that right?
Yes, Gourmandine. Yes.
Yeah, that was very nice. And I tried your
I've got the lavender and orange.
Yeah. But that one, it just it's still in the warm room. It's re-fermented. But I wanted to send you, but I don't know if it's fully re-fermented yet. But it's something new with some malt that is infused with
Right.
lavender and orange peel. So we're trying. Yeah, we're trying now to make like we have our standard beers, so more traditional Belgian beers, and then we have our like our Joker collection where we try to do some experiments and have fun as a brewer to see to try new things.
And are you selling mainly like directly? Are you selling in bars? How are you? Are you selling locally? What's your
Local in the local supermarkets. It's 50 kilometers around the brewery and the bars, but now with the situation, it's complicated, of course, for everybody.
No, I'm just wondering about the kind of like what I suppose what the reception is to, doing something a little bit different with them, but still keeping that Belgian tradition. Because I know your flagship one, the Thor, was I tried that the other night, and it's a double, isn't it? But
Yeah, it's a strong Belgian dark ale, but we did a little twist. We used peated malt to have some more character, and also some bourbon chips in it.
Yeah, not the bourbon, but I got the peat in it, and that was it was like it was recognizably a double, but there was just that little twist, and it was almost too sweet for me, but then the peat would just come in and kind of cut it out,
Yeah.
Did you try it?
Yeah, I tried it last night. I tried a lot of your beers last night, Peter. He was a very well. He's open-minded enough. He likes a lot of our beers, but he wouldn't know a lot of Belgian styles and like that. So he'd go a favor with it. But he liked most of them. He liked everything actually, except the apple and blackcurrant, which he didn't.
Ah, yeah, I understand.
That was a bit of a shock to his system.
I like the apple of blackcurrant.
good few of them. They're all very for me, the triple actually. Maybe because in my head, we've just brewed a double called Double Irish. And Belgian, traditional Belgian styles are what are in my head. It was interesting to try the triple.
And tonight too. So yeah, so you, which one is the triple?
But it's also with a twist because it's not really like a traditional triple. It's also with more caramel malt. It's more amber color.
Yeah, it was malty.
Yeah. And what do you find in Belgium? Let me think what I was trying to ask here because I suddenly went out of my head.
No problem.
Yeah. So when you're picking on the twist, do you get that into the bars? Do people come looking for it then? Or how's your branding? Because your branding is very strong. Is it really built around that twist of having a twist in it?
I think it comes naturally when you brew. You want to make your own style and do your own thing. So even if you brew in a style, you try to color outside of the lines. I think it's in our DNA of our brewery. And it's the whole team. We all think together for new beers, what we're going to do. Even also the marketing, we think about the names, the images. I think it comes naturally too, because if you're just trying to say, I want to copy another triple, it doesn't work. People will maybe try your beer one time, but if it's not different or if there's no added value, they will keep drinking your beers.
No, I'm thinking, I don't know, you probably know Jeff from Hopped and Dormel.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
But he's always giving out about people just like Belgians are just brewing more triples and just putting an Abbey name on it and claiming it's loads of history.
Yeah, no, we're a really young brewery, so we're not trying to say we're monks or anything.
And Patrick, down in Spain, would there be much demand for Belgians, or would that be completely?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. We're just down the road from us, there's a Belgian bar, which does well. I think it's the classics over here, the sort of Rochefort's, Lambics as well are popular here for sure. There's a bar in Madrid which kind of specializes in Lambic, who does he's kind of very proactive on sourcing kind of rare stuff and that's popular. It's still niche. But I guess because Spain doesn't have that much sort of beer diversity in its own tradition, traditional styles from other countries like, Belgian or whether it's, some British bitters and this kind of stuff or whatever, there's still a bit of a market for that. And I think that, there's always been, beer specific bars that were doing those kind of beers. But yeah, in terms of Spanish breweries brewing a lot of that kind of style, it's not it's not that popular because I guess it's easy to just get it from Belgium where they already do it very well. So sort of there's not that much need to do it, I would guess. And we definitely find things like those sort of styles if we put them on keg, for example, they take a lot longer to shift here. It's just not necessarily in the palate now.
I kind of think the same is true here, though. Like, you can get all the classics here as well, say, Sinn Féin and all that. But, when I was going to brew Spice Bag Saison, one of the things I like to do before I brew a style of beer, if I've never brewed the style before, taste as many iterations of that style as I can. If I'm making a Belgian Saison, I want to taste one from Belgium. And I went around several off-licenses, couldn't get a Belgian.
Yeah.
So, I suppose the point I'm making is that there's a certain amount of Belgian beer here. But it's very much, it's kind of mainstream Belgium, which isn't mainstream here, but in Belgium. Yeah. So, we don't see very many small Belgium.
Yeah, so it's craft in Ireland, but it's kind of like the big boys in Belgium. It's kind of like, I suppose, Guinness. Guinness in Ireland is everywhere, but outside of Ireland, it's considered a craft beer in a lot of places.
Yeah.
Same with Fuller's, people see Fuller's here and they'll go, oh, Fuller's, that's a kind of a nice niche one. And you go, yeah, but. If you live in London, you turn any corner and you find a Fuller's pub.
Yeah.
Peter, I just wondered what of the styles that you brew, which would be the kind of the flagship or like the core range or the bestseller of what are people or most of these?
Good question. The flagship. So we started with a Rio, Val di Crio, the triple. Amber Triple. But now we can see that Fevert, so the session IPA, is also doing really well. Everything is always seasonal, like the Tor, it's more in the winter. But we see that Fevert now, the people, even the Belgians that are conservative, are liking like session IPAs. They like that it's low in alcohol, I think, and with a lot of hops without being too bitter. So these two are really doing well at the moment.
What's the alcohol?
But it changes. Yeah, what's alcohol, it's 4.7%. For Belgians, it's low.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing. All Belgian beers are traditionally very, very strong. whereas, like we were saying earlier, like in Ireland and the UK, it would be much more a session. You're going into the pub and you're drinking, so you want something that's you're not going to fall over after three drinks, you know.
Lads want a pint.
Because I remember the first time I went out in Belgium, I tried a few Duvels and I was falling off. Didn't expect the effect that it had, you know.
Yeah.
No one hides alcohol like the Belgians. This is fine. They probably.
Yeah. Then you just fall.
Some of them only show the Plato. They're like, I can't calculate this right now. Whatever it is.
But you think, it comes up for me, like, is it harder to, or because we have the two sides, I suppose, Spain and Belgium, like, is it harder to convince people to try new beers in, say, Spain, where they don't have the culture, or in Belgium, where it's a very, maybe, you know, set culture on the beers and what a beer should be?
Well, I'd say for Spain, I think, in the right situation, I think they're very open-minded. They've got, they don't necessarily have a beer culture. They've got a very strong food and drink culture. And so they'd be very much, open to trying stuff. We find in Madrid that because we're a Madrid brand, sort of regionality is a huge thing here. So for better or worse, sometimes you'll see things in the news, I suppose. But people have a real strong identity of their city, of where they're from. They're from Madrid, but also the region of Madrid. And so if it's a Madrid brand, they'll want to give it a go. And so getting them to try it is not that difficult, especially among the younger generation. But that goes two ways, because that means that the current sort of big player in your region will be, people will feel a lot of loyalty to that brand. So getting them to try it is quite easy. Getting them to move is not always that easy, because it's there's a saying here, the Mao de toda la vida, which is like the Mao of all your life. This is like my grandparents have been drinking this since the 1900, and so you're like, well, my great grandparents have been drinking this since 1900, and it's just sort of, this is what we do. We go out and we have a few bottles or a few doubles of Mao, and that's it. So you do convince people, but it's got to be based on them really liking the beer, and that's, I suppose, as it should be.
What do you think, Peter? Is it, do you think the fact that people are, have this strong beer culture, have an idea of what beer should be? Because Belgium has, it has quite a wide range of beer cultures, from your Abbeys to your Saisons to the Lambics to the Flemish Reds and that. So do you think people kind of stick on what they have there as well? Or?
Yeah, I think what's your name again? Sorry, from Oslo Brewery,
Patrick.
Patrick said that it's really also regional dependent and generation from generation. So, and maybe it's also changing now how people drink.
Like I said, it is changing a bit slowly. I have a question here actually from Taris. He's asking me a question again. I'm just wondering, what do you do, collaborations? Do you do a lot of collaborations, or
do you stick? We don't tend to collaborate with other breweries, to be honest. We've done some, but we collaborate with other food producers and other small company cans. So there's a local company called Richmond Cordial who harvest elder flowers and make cordial from it, and we use theirs in a beer. We collaborate with a whiskey distiller, local chocolate maker, the spices guy I spoke about earlier. We do a lot of collaborations with other small companies, but not necessarily with other breweries.
We do a few. We do a few. I mean, collaborations among, you know, I guess a bit like what Liam's saying, we've done some stuff with, you know, some stouts of people that will be making, you know, their own chocolate or their own flavoured chocolate and stuff like that. We do a few with other breweries. You know, I would say there's probably a bit too much of it. I mean, you know, I mean, I would love to do, you know, a collaboration with a traditional established maker of Gers, because that would be fascinating. I would love that. But doing an IPA with someone else who's done an IPA, it's just sort of, you know, it's not like, and you know, I mean, it's a marketing thing, you know, there's no point sort of bullshitting, there's no point lying about it. You know, it helps to sell some stuff sometimes, but I think it's sort of lost its, for me, it's lost its excitement. You know, I don't see why two breweries that are already very good at doing a certain style, doing it together, it's going to make it that much better. So, you know, we'll sometimes do some, you know, it's a great day. You know, it's a lot of fun. Go to a brewery and, you know, hang out with other people and have a lot of fun. It's nice to build those relationships. But I think realistically, being completely honest, in the end product of the beer, it doesn't always make that much difference. But like I said, if you can go, you know, if you have people who are specialists in various things, then I think it can be great, you know, it can be a good outcome.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me, especially as you mentioned about IPAs. I mean, if you're just swapping out hops there and doing some different hops that, you know, that one person has used and the other hasn't, then doesn't. How about you, Peter? Do you do a lot of collaborations or?
We do collaborations, but with other local, like the farmer on the other side of the road, not really with brewers. Even with brewers, we collaborate, but it's more in behind the scene. It's not making a beer together. We help each other out with hops, malts, cardboard. In Belgium, the small brewers, it's really familiar, especially now with some problems with delivery of cardboard boxes, like, for example. We help each other out. But we work together for like the apple and black currant with a local farmer. And for our malt, our Pilsner malt is also from the farm just on the other side of the road. So we do like, we think more in collaboration, like in durable local stuff. But it would be interesting, like Patrick said, to do a collaboration with a brewer that is an expert in a specific style, like Oudbrunn or Gers. That would be interesting. But just doing the same beer, it can be fun, of course, to brew together, but I don't know if there's really added
effort. One brewery is known for one style of beer, the other is known for the other style of beer, and they come up with some way of creating a hybrid style or something, and that's
combining.
It has a proper USP. That's interesting, but as Patrick said, like, let's get together.
Yeah, just to brew the same beer. But yeah, no, more interesting thing sounds like what both Peter and Liam's talking about there, like collaborating with kind of food companies or local producers about something else that you're trying to match in. It actually brings up something I had a question to ask you, Liam, about on all your packaging, you mentioned the food that you think it should be paired with.
Yeah.
Yeah, so where did you come up? Is that something that you already had in mind that you think about when you're drinking a beer that you just put down?
I always think about it when I'm drinking beer. I always think about food immediately.
But you don't put out like a pack of potatoes or something like that.
Yeah. It's like we're very focused, and we always think the beer should be enjoyed at the dish as wine is. Like we have this huge reputation for beer in our country. Like a lot of restaurants are beer offered at all. It has improved over the last few years, but sometimes you go to a very high end restaurant and you ask to see the beer list, you're crazy, and they offer you a bottle of Heineken. And for me, like somebody who looks after beverages in a restaurant, particularly if they're going to charge 30 or 40 for a plate of food, should be looking after the beer list too. And that's part of why we put that on the bottles. Because for me, like bringing in wine from another country to serve with food is great, but if you're going to be a proper Irish restaurant serving Irish fare, then you should be serving them, and you should be talking about them with your food, because we all talk about sourcing the meat from a local farmer and all that, but nobody ever talks about where the beer came from.
Yeah, no, it struck me immediately, like, that you had it on everyone, even on the cans, which was, I could have understood the bottle.
Yeah, look, we're not trying to be overly serious with it, but you know, we have a bit of fun with it as well. So yeah. There's generally one there that, you know, we were thinking about when you land home from the pub full of beer and you're looking around your kitchen for something. There's one of our takes in that direction, but food and beer for me are very important. Sorry, forklift there. No.
Brewer's life.
I see that one, the cheese and ham toasty with nice dollop of mustard, which sounds good actually at the moment.
I don't know. I'll just ask about one other beer here that I had. Patrick, your Berliner Weiss. I didn't try it yet, but that seemed out of character of the pastry stouts and the triple IPAs. Do you sell a lot of that, or what made you?
We do every couple of months. We'll do a Berliner Weiss with fruit, and they sell really. They go great. I mean, it's quite a strong cider culture here in Spain. I don't know if you know that.
No, not at all.
This up in the north. It's the one where they sort of pour it, they pour it up here into a glass. Well, you can't see obviously from Zoom, but they pour it from as far as up as high as they can go to as low as they can go, aerated out. That's very popular. So they're not sort of unused to that, acidic, sort of fruity style. And the fruited Berliner Weisses go really well. We normally will stick around. We'll normally do it with berries, some sort of combination. We're trying out to try and, a lot of what we're doing is really kind of experimenting, trying to hone things down for our core range. And so, we do a lot of those and they go, we put a fair bit of fruit in there. So they're kind of got that balance of some sweetness and the acidity. And again, it's also, you know how it is with craft beer, it's the cliche that we brew what we like to drink, but you do also kind of have to, otherwise you can't be just tasting beer going, I don't know if it's any good because it's not my style. It's you kind of have to brew the stuff that you like to drink. And we're sessionable pale ales and sessional IPAs. We like to drink, fruited Berliner Weiss we like to drink, and the occasional double IPA, not drinking that as much. It's what we like, and I think it's a lot. You're definitely better at being self-critical and working on recipes when it's the stuff that you like. So
maybe look, I've held you now way beyond the time that I promised to hold you, but maybe I could just ask you one question each. Is there, because it just comes on from that, is there a style of beer that you want to brew that you've never brewed? Peter, you start toasting.
Okay. I was thinking about Oudbruin. I don't know if you know Brouwers Verzet.
Yep.
They went to visit our brewery recently, and I wanted to blend. They give some courses in blending for Oudbruin. It's Flemish red, I think, in English. But I had a wedding. I was best man at the wedding, so I couldn't go. But I'm really looking forward to learn how to blend because I don't have any experience with that yet. So that would be a style I really want to. I look forward to brewing. Yeah.
It's funny, blending was actually what I was going to as well. It's something I've been playing around a little bit. But when you play around with these things, eventually you realize you haven't got a bloody clue what you're doing. So I need to educate myself as well. The other thing I'd say is that Spice Bag Saison was the first Saison we've ever brewed. And Saison is an amazing style for experimenting with various ingredients because it really acts as a platform to let other ingredients shine, is what I think. So I'm going to be doing a lot more playing around with Saisons as well, but blending is something I've had in my head for a while now.
For me, the blending is, would love to do it, but not even anywhere near brave enough to consider it right now. I think I would, there are lots of styles that we don't brew that I would like to brew, but I would like to get us to the point where we could start to do some craft beer here in Spain, because I think that would just, we'd be able to get a lot of people excited. So I think we will do it someday. I love drinking ESBs and best bitters and stuff. Used to drink that a lot when I was in the UK. I really miss it. I whilst I'm a southerner, I am a big sparkler. I like craft beer through a sparkler. And so I would love for us to do those kind of beers. Probably not on the same scale we would do some of the other beers. Stick them into casks and then have a nice handful in our own bars and in our tap room and that kind of stuff. And I just, when it gets cold, that's just the beer I want to drink. So That's what I would like to do.
Okay, well, maybe someday we'll see some exciting changed beer, something that you're trying that you're going to come out of this. The blending is something actually that I'm fascinated with, but I don't know anything about it either. But listen, I've held you now for, it's an hour and a half, so I think it's about time to let you go. Thanks a million for taking part. It was a pleasure, and thanks. I'm looking forward to tasting some more of these beers now that I've got more knowledge about them.
Thanks for having us. Yeah,
really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you very much for our lovely beers.
Yeah.